I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jen Waite joins me now. She's written a remarkable book, A Beautiful, Terrible Thing. A new mother discovers her husband, the father of her daughter, is the textbook definition of a psychopath. It's a first-person account of attraction turning into love, turning into a relationship, turning into parenthood, turning into a marriage, and subsequently heartbreak. She has triumphed through and joins me now to talk about the book that's come out of the ruins. She's now pursuing a career in therapy so she can help many others. Her experiences are unfortunately all too common, as Jen will attest. I'll get her to tell us about the signs to spot a psychopath and just how her experience might be illustrative to others. Jen Waite lives in Maine with her young daughter and is pursuing a graduate degree to become a licensed therapist. Her website is at jenwaite.com. The Twitter handle is at jenwaite4444. The book is published by Plume. Please welcome to the Planta Online program in Toronto today, Jen Waite. Ms. Waite, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So some of the names in the book have been changed, obviously. So when we're referring to Marco, who was your husband, in terms of what, say, attracted you to him, when the first time you met him, was that instantaneous that you liked one another, say?
Yes, I would say it was pretty much instantaneous. It really felt like, you know, there's no other way to describe it than to say that it really felt like a movie where the room literally stands still, and I just felt this instant, really intense attraction. And I think that it was because of the way that he zeroed in on me. He just, the way that he looked at me, flattery and attention, it was unlike anything I had ever experienced before. I had been in love before. I was 25 when I met him, so mm-hmm. I had other boyfriends, but I hadn't felt what I thought was the love that is portrayed in movies and TV and books. And when I met Marco and he made me feel like the most important person in the world, I really truly believed that I was actually falling in love for real for the first time.
Yeah, and you guys were living in Manhattan. You were, I guess, working at the same restaurant. You were out on auditions booking modeling and acting gigs. Is that right?
Yes, well, we were actually living in Astoria, Queens, which is just a couple subway stops into Manhattan. But yeah, working, auditioning in Manhattan, and then I was waitressing and he was bartending at a restaurant in Astoria, and that is where we met.
Yeah, so you alternate in the book between, I'd say, the past, when you initially meet him, and then sort of when everything unravels, and you go back and forth, and it's a good way to show the reader just how much you don't know. As everything's happening around you, and it's sort of, you know, I guess what makes a book so good is that it's like a jigsaw puzzle that you're putting together as one reads the book, and you really see, say, the distance of time and place and how everything comes together.
Exactly, think it's important to show the beginning and the end almost simultaneously, mm-hmm. because a lot of times with these relationships, these kind of relationships that end in just utter betrayal, you can't really believe that it could have been a good relationship, or that the person didn't see it coming, or you just can't understand how everything unraveled like that or just shattered completely. So I thought it was really important to kind of take the reader along on both journeys kind of at the same time, so that you're experiencing the blooming, the falling in love, the just intensity of it, and then also the crash.
Yeah, so I mean, when you look back at it all, I mean, do you see the warning signs now? I mean, there's a moment in the book where you introduce him to your parents, and your dad's a pretty good judge of character, and your mom is as well. She says, I don't know if it was offhand or not, but, you know, he has a lot of baggage.
Yes. So I definitely see several warning signs now, and I'm really happy about that, because I believe that in any type of relationship with a person like this, there are warning signs in the beginning. And, you know, the biggest warning sign, I think, is what I already described, that it was so perfect and just so amazing and so intense in the beginning. And that was after, you know, a couple of weeks. And so whenever you get to know someone, I think it's great to feel a connection and chemistry, but that kind of intensity and just extreme attraction, that is not, I don't think, that really can't be genuine after that short amount of time. So that was for sure one of the red flags. Another red flag is that he, at the beginning, always had, he had a lot of, you know, what I call pity plays or sob stories about his past, and they were always told, or he always told them when I would call him out on some kind of bad behavior, not calling me, or, you know, not, you know, the actions not aligning with the words, suddenly he would have this really, really sad story where he was the victim, and it kind of changed the narrative completely. So there were definitely some red flags that I did not, or I did not choose to see, I would say, because I felt a little bit sick to my stomach at the beginning, the first few months. I remember really clearly feeling like this is so amazing and I'm so in love, but also feeling a little bit sick to my stomach, and kind of rationalizing that away by, well, I'm falling in love and that's why. But now I would tell other people, if you do feel that kind of sick to your stomach, that is your, you know, your instincts telling you that, your body telling you something is off.
Yeah, if it's too good to be true, it probably is, right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Now, are all cheaters psychopaths? I mean, and what makes Marco different from, say, your run-of-the-mill philanderer or cheater?
Yeah, no, definitely not all cheaters are psychopaths, because that would make a lot of people psychopaths. And luckily, the statistics that, you know, in the psychiatry community are 1 in 25 people fall on the psychopathy spectrum. So the majority, you know, still 24 out of 25 do not. So that's good. So I would say that a run-of-the-mill cheater is going to at some point feel some kind of empathy or remorse and guilt and own up eventually. They're not actually going to actively be enjoying the pain and the destruction that they're causing. You know, I obviously, like, especially after what I've been through, I don't condone cheating, and I always think that there's another way to kind of move away from a relationship rather than cheating or betraying. However, I do know that it does happen quite frequently, and for a non-disordered person, it could be because of a breakdown in the relationship or emotional or physical needs not being met. And in those cases, the cheater, you know, will feel like they're in the pit of their stomach, like they're doing something wrong. Whereas a psychopath or narcissist, they don't feel that at all. They have no remorse, no empathy, no guilt, which makes it extremely easy for them to do whatever they want, basically. They feel nothing about it.
Yeah, and eventually, in some cases, do terrible things. You hear psychopaths kill people and harm people physically, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I read that the majority of serial killers are psychopaths. Mm-hmm. However, there are also many, many, many people who fall on the spectrum who aren't serial killers. So I think that a lot of people maybe still associate the term psychopath with, like, murderers in prison, because it is, like, a really charged, loaded word in popular culture, and you know, for good reason. But there are, it's good to keep in mind as well that there are a lot of, like, normal-looking, charming, attractive people walking around who have these traits and maybe don't go around killing people but go around causing destruction in people's lives and, you know, basically enjoying it.
Yeah. Now, Marco's parents and his sister, you develop a closeness with them. The sister was living overseas, is that right?
Yes, that is right. That's correct.
But you maintained a relationship with her throughout all of this, texting her and talking to her. And then the parents, I guess they were living there from Argentina, is that right?
I did change identifying details, but yes, we'll say they're from Argentina.
Sure. And so they come to stay with you in New York, and you develop this closeness with them. Were they, because they knew Marco the longest, were they in on who he was, say?
You know, that's an interesting question. I've thought about this a little bit, and I don't think that they were in on it. I think that they were kind of like me, blinding themselves to a lot of his behavior and really, really, really happy and hopeful once he met me and seemed to become this really great guy. I think that they were genuinely hopeful that perhaps, you know, his bad boy days were over and he was becoming the person that he was meant to be, you know, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that now I do wonder if they were kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, because I think that probably there was a lot in his past behavior that they saw, that they probably were worried about coming back. So I don't think that they were in on it or plotting or anything like that, but I think that they were also very much kind of living in a delusion, like I was, about who he was as a person.
Yeah, and to that extent, too, because we meet in the book Seb, who is Marco's son from a previous relationship. Do we see that in his mother? Because when you first meet, she's really glad that you're in their life, finally.
Exactly. It's like, it's, you know, everyone has their own paradigm and way of looking at reality, and it's subjective. It's totally different from person to person. And for her, it was really great that he met me and suddenly started hanging out with Seb more and becoming like a much better father. So for her, it doesn't really, you know, do her any harm to just hope for the best and think, okay, maybe he's turning around. Maybe again, like, his immature days are behind him. So I think that everyone was kind of like a little bit living in their own reality and choosing to see what they wanted to see, basically, until everything fell apart. And then Nat, I call her Nat in the book, she really, I don't think I wrote about this in the book, but we had some conversations where she said she felt just this sense of, like, she was free, finally, because she had been holding a lot of self-judgment and anxiety with relation to him, because he would kind of make subtle comments a lot about her, and she had been internalizing them for the longest time. And so she said, when this all happened with you, she's like, I hate to say it's a positive thing at all for me, but she was able to totally free herself from that and realize, okay, it's not me, it's him, because she had been dealing with that for 10 years at that point.
Yeah, see, this is what your book does that I think is tremendously useful. It gives people a way to talk about these things or to name these things these feelings that they had that they didn't know about.
Exactly.
Right. And so, I mean, you talk about it in the course of the book. You're telling people that you hadn't run into in a couple of years what happened to your marriage, and they tell you that happened to me too. I know someone like that.
Yeah, it's really, for me, it's been pretty shocking how many other people have come to me and told me very, very similar stories that they have been through, and I would have never known. And I think it's a lot more common than most people think, at least than I thought, having never gone through something like that before. And I think a lot of people don't talk about it because there is this sense of shame or I should have known better. I mean, especially when it's your partner of, you know, however many months or years, and you are supposed to know them better than anyone and completely trust them, and you realize that you never knew them at all. It's kind of hard to explain to someone else how that could happen, and you kind of just end up sounding crazy, so you don't even try. So I hope that by me kind of being able to, or feeling really compelled to write all of this down and pretty close to when it was happening, which I think is also part of the reason why it is a pretty compelling read, is because I was writing very, very close to the events and everything was just kind of pouring out. But I hope that, you know, it does validate other people's experiences with this type of relationship.
So what was it a catharsis then for you to write this? And I guess it, you'll correct me if I'm wrong. It did help move on from all of the pain, right?
Yes. No. Definitely. I mean, I think even if it hadn't been sold to a publisher, and you know that whole part of the journey was erased, I think just writing it down and just getting it out of my body was extremely cathartic and healing, because that was my outlet, and I had no idea that was how I was going to respond to kind of being in this pain and grieving, you know, this relationship and really the future that I thought I would have. But for me, that was my outlet to kind of, I guess, exercising it from my body, was to just write it all out. And so that in itself was very, very healing.
And so other than the cheating, in the book, you talk about an investment that you'd made in a bar or a restaurant. Is that right?
Yes.
And so, so in the course of a divorce, I guess because New York has no contest divorce laws, you're saddled with that debt. Are you still today?
That actually I can't really talk about.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
It is an ongoing situation, and I actually have signed a non-disclosure agreement about that, so
right.
I can't really talk about that. However, I will say that the financial aspect of it is really interesting, because so many people, when they tell me these stories, it is like it's an emotional betrayal, physical betrayal, and then financial as well. It is like these psychopaths and narcissists just use you like from all angles, and it's crazy. I mean, they try to destroy you, basically.
Yeah. Now, so what's it like when you go back to New York City now, where everything happened and where you and Marco had lived? I mean, do things come back to you, and over time, does that pain go away? Like if you hear the Happy Song, for example, the Pharrell Williams thing.
Right.
I mean, that brings back some memories, does it? And is it painful at all?
Yeah, I mean, the first time that I went back to New York, maybe a year after everything happened, it was very strange and very nostalgic and very, very bittersweet feeling, because I was walking, because a lot of my friends still live in the neighborhood that we lived. So I was walking along, you know, those same streets in my home, and I had left so abruptly that I didn't really feel like I had any closure at all. So all of a sudden kind of being back there was a very kind of strange, bittersweet experience. But I will say that it's now been 2 years, over 2 years, since everything happened, and I was just in New York yesterday for my book launch.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have those. I was in the same neighborhood, and I didn't have those feelings at all. So it took quite a bit of time, and I think that the book was also a huge factor in becoming just pretty much completely resolved about everything, about him, our relationship, myself, my role in the relationship. Like, I really have done a lot of work to become resolved about a lot of it. I'm still, you know, working on it, and it's an ongoing process. But I definitely, this past trip, I felt, like, pretty free from, I guess, those memories.
I mentioned earlier that you've changed some of the details to, you know, so to protect some of the people that you talk about in the book. But the character of Seb I found particularly compelling, because he just seems like a character in and of himself. And he's only 9, right?
He was at the time. I mean, I met him when he was 7.
Yeah.
He's 14 now, which is really crazy. But in the book, yeah, he was, I think, anywhere from 7 to 10.
And so he's like that. He's a funny character, like you portray him in the book.
He is such a character. I mean, now he's more of a teenager, so a little more dry and not so much. But seriously, when he was that age, in person, even 10 times more than I could describe on the page. Like, he was just such a little character, and I think that had a lot to do with the fact that Nat, his mom, and like one of my best friends still, has always just talked to him like an adult. She's a very also kind of quirky, funny person, and so just the way that they communicate, it's like they're like an odd couple themselves, which is, so he's always been like a little adult, no matter what the age. So I think now it's just not as funny because he's getting older. But when he was seven and using these words, you know, with four syllables and just like so articulate, it was, you know, you had to just like try not to laugh because you don't want to let him know that it's really cute because you want him to keep doing it. But he's a great kid.
He gets up at your wedding, DeMarco, and tells everyone he doesn't believe in certain things because he's an atheist.
yes, that really did happen. I had his he had written his speech on my laptop, so I still had the Word document, so I was able to get his exact line about that, which was just really, really cute and funny.
And does Marco maintain a relationship with him?
I actually just talked to Nat about that last night because we went out to dinner after my book launch and was just asking, you know, what's going on with that whole relationship. And she said that, and Seb is very aware about this and kind of mature, you know, although he is still a kid and it is still his father. But basically, after everything happened between me and Marco, Marco kind of did slip back into he will see Seb when it is extremely convenient for him, like when he is basically served on a golden platter. But other than that, you know, he's not doing much. And Nat, it's funny because she was saying that she still feels bad for him. And it's like, it's really crazy. Like you can know all of these things and these people will still manage to make you feel sympathy for them. So,
but you don't have sympathy for him yourself, do you?
I don't. I feel very creeped out by the whole, just the whole situation, by him in general as a person. I have no sympathy because when I think about him now, I think about his words and then think about his actions, and it's very chilling to me now. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think because, you know, Nat saw everything happen and was extremely supportive for me, but it didn't happen to her, so she's experiencing a different reality than I am. So she, you know, instead of being absolutely pain-stricken and heartbroken and this and that, she's seeing it through her lens, and so she's kind of like, well, he's, you know, a complete you-know-what, mm-hmm. but I think he's, you know, he's messed up and has so many problems, and she still feels, like, bad for him, basically.
Yeah. So what will you tell your daughter about her father?
Well, everything is out in the book, so I realistically know that she'll read the book someday, so she's two right now. I think going forward, when she gets old enough to really, you know, start asking these questions, I'm going to be truthful and in kind of an age-appropriate way and not, you know, go into details until she's old enough to really understand and talk about it with me. But I'm going to tell her that, you know, her father doesn't have the capability to love in the same way that I do and Granddad does and Mimi does and all these other people who love you and, you know, are there for you. And your biological father just doesn't, he doesn't have that. And so he made some really bad decisions, and that's why he's not part of our life. That's kind of what I what I have scripted in my head so far. And then I'm hoping that by the time she reads the memoir, it'll be in 10 years or so.
Yeah.
And who knows where we'll be, and how, you know, how much can happen in 10 years. But I'm hopeful that it might actually be interesting for her to have such a detailed account of what her mother, or what happened, just what happened when she was born, because I think that is really what I did. I wasn't judging, it wasn't like this spiteful revenge type memoir. It was literally just through my lens of exactly what happened. So it might be interesting for her to know that at some point.
How are you able, Jen, to trust again? I mean, and what about love? I mean, how are you able to love again?
Yeah, I think I have thought about that as well a lot, and I definitely went through probably a few months to a year where I was pretty against that whole idea of trusting again, loving again, just didn't believe in it, didn't think that any couple could truly be happy. I went through a long period of feeling like that, and I think those feelings were coming more from a place of fear and anxiety, obviously. And then I'd say in the past year, and really stemming from all of the work that I've done with my therapist on myself, I mean, it really has more to do with me looking inward than researching psychopathy or anything like that. But now that I understand how to judge a person based on actions and not words, and, you know, how to just very objectively as possible look at someone and see if they have integrity and if they're honest. And I'm actually looking forward to having at some point a relationship with another person that is not perfect and, you know, intense and like fireworks going off every 5 minutes, but is real and satisfying and, you know, probably really hard at some points. But again, is a real relationship. And I think that I am pretty equipped now to differentiate between a psychopath and, you know, a quote unquote normal guy at this point.
Your therapist, Lisa, tells you as you see her and talk to her throughout this, that she was like you once, and I guess that sort of inspired you to get into this the work that you're doing now to become a therapist. Do you think the good ones have to go through shit like, you know, terrible things to be helpful to other people, say?
I don't know about that, because I think that most people have gone through really difficult situations, and I think that kind of the difference between people who are able to move forward and people who aren't is that self-awareness and being willing to face, you know, yourself and not blame external factors 100%. So I think that probably everyone has gone through, you know, difficult situations, and the people who kind of come out on the other side and want to help other people are probably the ones who realized that, you know, looking inward is really the most empowering piece of moving forward. And so I think that that's also where I kind of came to that realization, why I wanted to help other people, because I feel like I had kind of uncovered so much about myself that was always there, but I had just never tapped into before, and it was just such an empowering discovery, and that's really what led me to want to help other people who have been in this type of situation not, you know, go through the same pattern again and again and again. And that is a story that I hear a lot. A lot of people, mostly women, have written to me that they're on, you know, their second or their third relationship with a person that they've just discovered, again, is disordered or narcissist or has these traits. So that is a really, I think, just important piece of it, that the people who can eventually help other people are the ones who have probably confronted their own demons, so to say, really worked on themselves first.
Now, this book is written, obviously, from the perspective of someone who has been affected by a psychopath, the victim, if you will. Can the psychopath themselves, can they be cured at all?
I don't think so. I was just talking to a psychiatrist about this, and he's of the opinion that if you can get them into a therapist's office in the first place, then there could be hope. If they have gotten to a point where they've just lost everything, they have to really be at, I guess, ground zero to want help, but I kind of disagree. I think that the someone with, you know, these traits, this cluster of personality traits, it's a genetic disorder. Mm-hmm. I am of that opinion that it is, you know, mostly nature, and I think even if they are so-called cured, those traits will crop up again, or that behavior will begin again, because I think it is an instinctive kind of cycle that they go through, just cycling through people and using people for their own gain. So I tend to think that no, the mm-hmm. people really who are truly lack empathy, I don't think that that's really a skill that can be learned.
Have you any sense at all as to Marco's reaction to this book? I mean, in a way, he might be displeased that he's exposed, but in another way, might he enjoy that his exploits are written about like this?
That's honestly what I'm hoping. and so far, you know, I haven't heard anything, and he kind of dropped off the face of the earth with respect to me and my daughter when I unmasked him.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I am hopeful that, yes, that if anything, he might enjoy it and stay kind of off the radar. But it's really difficult to tell when you're dealing with someone who is very unpredictable and doesn't react at all in the way that you would think. So it's hard for me to say.
Yeah, and so the anger that you have for yourself, the blame, if you will, the regrets, I mean, regret's a terrible thing to deal with. I mean, do you think you're over that now after writing this book and after some time has passed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I feel that I had to go through this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was obviously a huge lesson that I had to learn, and I wouldn't wish it upon anyone else. But at the same time, I wouldn't change anything for myself, because clearly I was not living in a truthful way. I was ignoring really, really bad, you know, characteristics of other people and just seeing what I wanted to see and not really being honest with myself. So for me, it's really changed kind of everything and how I go through life now and how I'm, you know, see reality. I actually try to see all the data instead of just what kind of fits into my paradigm. And so it's definitely more difficult and, you know, more messy, and it doesn't always feel great, but I wouldn't change it, because I think that for the first time I'm living in a really more truthful way than ever before.
And you're helping a lot of people already, aren't you?
I hope so. I mean, that's gotten some just amazing feedback from other people that have read the book and just, you know, say that for the first time they feel, like, comforted and validated, and it's really, really helping them with their own struggles that they're going through, or something that happened a long time ago that they buried and never talked about. So, yeah, I mean, that really feels really, really great.
I wish you all the best with this book and everything else, because you've been through a hell of a lot and somehow have come through and given a lot of us lessons through this book. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
The book is called The Beautiful Terrible Thing, A Memoir of Marriage and Betrayal. Plume is its publisher. Jen Waite, its author, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.